Welcome back, Teachers on Fire, to another episode of the Teachers on Fire podcast. I'm so glad that you've spent some of your day tuning in. My goal, my objective here is to warm your heart, spark your thinking, and ignite your professional practice. Today's Teacher on Fire is Phil Stringer. Phil is the department head of mathematics at Crofton House School in Vancouver. With over 25 years in education, Phil has presented locally, nationally, and internationally in assessment and pedagogy. Outside of the classroom, he can be found coaching soccer or hiking with his family in the local mountains. You can follow Phil on X at XPhilS. And Phil, I have to say, by the way, that was a very fortuitous choice of your X handle. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Are you ready to light it up?
I am. Let's do it.
All right. That's what I like to hear. Just as we get started here, want to say good morning to a couple of friends. We've got Shannon Schinkel tuning in from Prince George. She says, good morning from snowy Prince George. Excited to listen to my infinitely wise pal Phil this morning. Thank you for joining us, Shannon. And I have to say, shout out to Embrace the Messy podcast, because I really enjoyed listening to your episode with Phil this week. We've also got a hello from our other BC friend, Brian Carpenter, coming to us from Abbotsford this morning. Looking forward to hearing from Phil and Tim. And you know, it's funny, Phil, for me to read those words, because my next brother's name is actually Phil. So here we are, Phil and Tim. All right, here we go. Let's jump into the conversation. And Phil, before we get into everything that you have to share about math and assessment, I'd actually like to start with a story of adversity. Tell us about some kind of challenge that you faced in your teaching or professional journey and how you overcame it.
I'm going to go way back to right after I graduated. So I graduated from UBC in 95 with a teaching degree. And there were actually very few jobs in BC at that time for teachers. So I took a TOC position on the North Shore, which is where I'm from, and loved it. Taught almost everything. My teaching areas are actually mathematics and English. And so with that combo, I was doing social studies one day and chemistry and physics another day and some math. And I remember teaching Japanese for a week. And it was a really great experience, especially to build some capacity with classroom management and things like that. But after doing that for a year and then teaching summer school, I was looking for a more permanent position, and there was really still nothing. TOC'd for another year. I won't say I was getting despondent, but I certainly wanted my own classroom. And eventually found a very, very small ad in the newspaper that said, fax your resume to, I'm dating myself a little bit here, but I faxed my resume off and got a phone call, honestly, about 15 or 20 minutes later, coming for an interview tomorrow. And in I went, and it was a very small independent school in Vancouver. I think there were 52 students from grades 8 to 12. And I ended up teaching everything, math, science, PE, computer science, and loved it. And it was, I'd never been to an independent school. I didn't know anything about the system. I TOC'd exclusively in the public school system. And it started my career in the independent schools. That school ended up closing at the end of that year. And I applied to another basically new school in White Rock, and went and taught at Southridge for 10 years, and then moved from there into independent school here in Vancouver. So
very cool. That's a new story for me, Phil. And there's something interesting about those small school environments. Lots of pros and cons. I mean, you can get some really intimate communities. I know on the con side, sometimes you really get stretched, right? You kind of have to do everything, not just teach everything, but do all these other jobs as well. Interesting journey. Thank you so much for sharing. Let's talk about math, Phil. We hear this quote so many times, I'm not a math person. And it's not just something we hear from students, we hear it from teachers too. So how do you typically approach the math mindset conversation?
You know, in conversation, I hear it from parents. Sometimes if I'm meeting new people and they ask what I do and I say I'm a math teacher, I suddenly hear it from them. But I think it's really binary. I think people either consider themselves a math person or don't. And so I'll push back a little bit on I'm not a math person. I actually quite often hear I loved math. I just didn't see a place where I would go use it in the future. And I think it's really, you know, if the people are feeling that they're not a math person, it's really about finding, first of all, building relationship with people, and then finding ability to connect them to the math that's around them. Parents will come in and say that they're not a math people in a parent-teacher interview. They probably actually do use mathematics, and they probably don't even realize it. Even if they're an artist or a photographer, the rule of thirds is really based off Fibonacci sequence and the golden mean, and they maybe just haven't learned that kind of mathematics before. So just inspiring either parents or teachers or the students, for sure, to see the beauty of mathematics helps them understand that they are actually a mathematician and that algebra isn't the be-all and end-all of mathematics.
I've read Mindset, and that book, when I was working through my master's at VIU, was probably the most influential and impactful book that I read. And I've always remembered that when you think about all of the different subjects, probably nowhere is the fixed mindset more fierce, right, and more established than in the area of math. Well, I like that take, and I can't help but think, Phil, about our shared passion for Wordle. Actually, I'm going to diverge slightly because Wordle involves some math in a way too, doesn't it?
There's a lot of logic in Wordle, for sure. I've recently discovered hard mode, and I know we've chatted off this podcast a little bit about it. And it is, once you put hard mode on, it actually helps because there are less combinations of words that you can use. I mentioned just a little bit ago that I have a degree in English as well. So maybe that's my secret, is I have a pretty good five-letter word dictionary in my head. And then the mathematics of like the logics of, you know, I've got these ones in these places. Yeah, I started, I don't know, about a year ago, just plain Wordle and a few of the other variations of it. Yeah, it's fun. I haven't done today's yet, but.
Okay. Well, I mean, so Phil and I share a Wordle DM thread on X, and any day that I can beat Phil is a very good day. Let me just tell you that. Usually he's one or two moves ahead of me. Let's get back to math, Phil, and talk about Dr. Peter Liljedahl, another British Columbian, at least at the moment. What do you think are one to two of the most significant takeaways for teachers from his work at building thinking classrooms? And let's approach this for teachers out there who are really unfamiliar with his work, maybe haven't heard of it at all.
Yeah, and his book is absolutely fantastic. When teachers come to my school, it's one of the first books I put in their hand as kind of pre-reading before the school year starts. There's lots of aspects to this. I think he's got 13 chapters in that book. So I'm going to pick three. I'm going to plus one you. And
sure.
I have been using random groups from way before when that book was written. The ability for students to come in, not feel pressured in some ways to sit with their friends, their buddies, to be given a random group of people and know that it's just for 40 minutes or 50 or 60 minutes of class time where they are working together, collaborating on a problem. The next stage of that may be if a teacher has the ability to have what he calls vertical non-permanent surfaces, whiteboards in their classroom. And I'm blessed to have them around my room. So the students come in, they are given their random groups. I actually use a deck of cards to do that. And then I give them problems that they can work on at the whiteboards. I love the fact that they then can cheat and watch what some other students are doing around the room to get some hints and come back and work on their own problems as well. So those are my first two, the random groups and the whiteboarding. And then he has a couple of chapters on assessment that just really fit well with a lot of the trends that you're seeing in assessment these days, collecting the evidence over time and triangulating. He's basically describing standards-based grading with those two chapters in his book.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Yeah, transformative book, absolutely. And neither of us are affiliated. At least I'm not.
I'm not.
But but we strongly recommend picking up Building Thinking Classrooms. Well, something else related to his work there in assessment, Phil, is this idea of grading math homework. So this, I said, let's spice things up a little because this is a tough one. This is a tough one for math teachers who feel like if I don't grade this homework, if I'm not putting something in my grade book based on what students bring back the next day or during homework check or whatever that looks like, then students aren't going to do the work. But Dr. Peter has some good answers to that. So how do you respond and what's your take?
He definitely does, and I'll give my short answer, which is sure. I don't grade math homework. There's a few reasons. I don't know who did it. I don't know who has the capacity to do it. My son's in grade 8, and I know that I can form some time with him between soccer practice and all the other things, his job and all those other kinds of things that he's doing. So. But that's my family and my situation, his situation. The students do need to practice, and the teachers do need to ensure that they're getting adequate practice, but they don't need to grade it. It's formative work that is helping them figure out where they're at. I encourage my students to make sure that they're checking the back of the book, the answer key or answer keys that I provide online, to see if they're doing things correctly, because you definitely want the practice to solidify. Sometimes you hear practice makes perfect, but if they're not doing it right, practice makes the perfect wrong. You actually can think of that sentence as practice makes permanent. And so if a student can practice whatever it is that you want them to do correctly with some feedback, some timely feedback, then fantastic. This is part of the reason. So in upper level mathematics, my homework now for, 10 years has been watch a video. So it's a 10-minute video on YouTube. They can watch it whenever they want in the 48 hours between one class and the next class. And they can watch it twice. They can watch it right before. They can watch it basically anytime except during class. And then that's their homework, and we get together. So it's a flipped classroom model where then we get together and do mathematics together in the class, where I can give them quick feedback. They can give each other that kind of feedback as well. So if you design your classrooms without having to spend hours and hours and hours marking homework, I would encourage people to think about alternate ways to be able to get that formative feedback and that practice for their students.
Phil, do you use any tools like Edpuzzle to monitor the video watching, or you're not interested in following up on that angle? How do you play that?
I haven't. I played around years ago with some embedding questions before they could move forward in the videos that YouTube used to have inside it. I just haven't gone any further with that kind of video editing. My videos are very basic. First one took me about 2 hours to make a 15-minute video, and I got it down to about 18 minutes to make a 15-minute video now. So can churn out the math content fairly quickly.
Well, definitely take a look for Phil's YouTube channel. There's a lot of gold there on the math tutorial side. Phil, let's talk about how you teach math. You don't teach math as separate units, which is going to be interesting, I think, for a lot of math teachers. Can you explain how this works in your practice, and also how you document evidence of learning? Like, what does your grade book look like?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so these are the biggest questions, Tim.
Yeah.
So I noticed about 6 or 7 years ago that students were forgetting a lot of things that I had taught them. And I knew that they knew it. They had learned it a week ago, 2 weeks ago. They had tested well on it. I had seen lots of different evidence that they knew this information. And shortly thereafter, 2 weeks, 2 months, even a year after, they would say to me, "I don't even remember you ever teaching this to me." And I wondered why this was. So I happened across a book, Make It Stick, and the authors of that book, the neuroscientists, really had looked at reasons why information that we learn just disappears from our memory. And I thought there could be some changes that we could make to math classes that might help students remember things more long term. So I thought, I'll try and implement these. So I started with a grade 8 class. And one of the concepts was mixed practice, where you, instead of continuously doing the exact same thing, like a whole page of adding fractions, once they've learned how to do that, then incorporating the adding fractions into other areas of mathematics in what's called a spaced approach. So between mixing questions up and then spacing that learning out throughout the year, the only way that I could see really doing that was to get rid of these units that we had created. So a typical textbook will have, you know, one unit on fractions and another unit on algebra skills. And I thought, what if instead of just teaching each unit throughout the year and then they forget the units as you go through them, for the most part, we instead looked at all of the base skills across all units, taught those, and spiraled back to each unit as you go throughout the year. So I don't know if you thought about 10 learning outcomes that you wanted for a unit on fractions and then 10 on algebra and 10 on geometry. If you taught the first of each and then the second of each and then the third of each and built up the year that way. So I tried it out with a group of grade 8 students. This is just before COVID. We still had final exams at our school. And typically a group of students, no matter which group, honors group, regular group, enriched group, the final exams that I had given in my career would go down by about 4%, 5% as a class average compared to their year's work. And I would spend at least a month reviewing for those final exams. So I tried this deunitized approach and it seemed to be going very, very well. I actually finished the entire curriculum around spring break because I didn't have to do review. I didn't have to stop and review. Instead, as I was going along, I would give them smaller check-ins where I would test, say, three concepts at a time. So I would have one question on what's the fraction level of difficulty of work that we've done. And on that same assessment, geometry, and same assessment, algebra or probability. And I would give them these mixed assessments throughout the year. And then I would just collect that data. Eventually, we're now using standards-based grading. Eventually, I would just collect that data by strand or by standard and look at those patterns over time. And then they went and wrote the exam and their marks actually went up by 5% over their average for the year. And then I actually measured them again in September to see what their summer learning loss was. And they had much less loss over the summer than students in the same kind of course and grade that did not go through that deunitized approach. So I actually put all this together, went off to Boston, presented this at Learning in the Brain, a big neuroscience conference, and ran into the authors of Make It Stick at the conference, and they came to see my poster presentation and asked me lots of questions. And I've been working with them since, just to try to look at whether or not this is something that's scalable. We've now scaled it in our school, so all the way up to our grade 12 courses are no longer by unit. We do what's called chunks, so we'll do a little bit of fractions so that they get some time and practice with that, because the practice is definitely valuable to a new learner. And then we'll move on to another unit. And just as they're about to forget that, we'll come back and bring back in some fractions questions again. So it's a big change. We've had to rewrite a lot. The textbooks don't really support it, but our team's really committed to it here. And it's fantastic to see.
Phil, part of the picture, I think, for some of our non-British Columbians is this idea, and I'll just throw the curriculum up on the screen, which is going to be a little bit difficult for our podcast listeners, but part of the challenge here, and I'll put the question that I asked you back up, is this idea that you can, so the curriculum is divided into competencies on the left, which are essentially thinking habits, let's say, and then content on the right. And I think traditionally we really focus on the content of math, fractions, percents, proportional reasoning, linear relations, and that's sort of how the year unfolds. But if we think about the curriculum in terms of the competencies on the left, reasoning and applying, understanding and solving, communicating and representing, connecting and reflecting, those things, those competencies really do play out over the course of the whole year. And so in a sense, your learning targets and what you, the evidence that you're looking for doesn't change a whole lot over the course of the year, regardless of what you're studying. Did I represent that well?
Yeah, and that's where we've ended up going, is that instead of having content standards, so a standard on fractions and a standard on, I think the last one on the page there is like financial literacy on the right and the content side.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of focusing on those things, we focus on the four big topic areas of curricular competencies. And that's the focus. Like, the students just know that when they write an assessment and it's got three different content pieces on it, that we're holistically looking at how are they understanding and solving, or how are they reasoning and analyzing and justifying, or how are they making connections to real life. It does change the way that we have to ask questions. We need to make sure that we have questions that attach themselves, that they're not just all solve, which
right.
can definitely be a way that teachers will set up. It is much harder to set up questions where you're intentionally looking for explain and justify or make connections between these kinds of mathematics or mathematics in real life.
It's all about those key verbs, right?
Absolutely.
Number six, next question here for you, Phil. What have you learned lately about the science of learning, and how is it changing your instruction and leadership?
So again, that book, Make It Stick, is key to how I've transformed my own practice, the practice of teaching mathematics here at our school, and just even getting out into other school districts, other schools, and promoting them to see some of the myths that we may have heard of over the years, and some of the practices that students think work well, or students, they try something like cramming, they learn something the night before, and then they are actually fairly successful at whatever it happens to be the next day. And they see an illusion that they have actually mastered something that way. I guarantee you ask them a week later and they have crammed something else into their short-term memories. Mm-hmm. And so looking at learning from what do they understand year to year rather than what do they understand day to day is transformative in how is it that I can set up a classroom environment so that they can actually learn well. Unfortunately, once you start to see some of these studies that are coming out of MIT and Harvard and some of the brain research labs, and some of them are maybe fairly obvious. I don't know if you've ever watched a PowerPoint presentation and the person is speaking every single word on the PowerPoint presentation. We often tell kids not to do this. And the reason is that when you hear words being spoken, then they go in your auditory, they go in your ear and into your brain. When you read something, it actually goes into your brain through your auditory. So the voice inside your head actually puts that information. And so if somebody's reading and you're trying to listen at the exact same time, it is impossible to, because you only have one channel in. And so I promote this to teachers and administrators. Like, if you're going to do a talk for parents, don't have a million words up on the screen. They're going to read it and be talking at the same time. Do one or the other. So there's these small moves that we can make that might seem obvious later on, but again, that book, Make It Stick, another book called Powerful Teaching by Patrice Baines and Pooja Agarwal, just absolutely fantastic reads to think about some ways of bringing in some of these learning sciences, cognitive science things into a classroom.
Of course, when you're talking about learning and reinforcing learning over time, I worry about the whole ChatGPT culture and world that we live in today. But I know that's a whole other topic that maybe we won't get into just yet. Grammar nerds want to know, Phil, and this is a really practical question, but report card comment writers want to know. I think I messed up the question there, but anyway, you get the idea. Should we capitalize math in our comments? And if so, when?
No, generally you should not. The only time that you should capitalize math is if it is part of a course name. So right. Mathematics 8 gets capitalized and a student learns mathematics in my classroom does not get capitalized.
Right. Yes. Okay. Now, Phil, I'm going to go slightly off script here. I hope you don't mind, but I'm thinking about the proficiency scale. And first of all, I have to just confirm are you teaching any grade 8 or 9 courses this year?
I'm not teaching 8, 9 courses this year, but we actually use the proficiency scale for all of our classes.
Oh, you do? Okay. Yep. Well, that's really interesting. Okay. So I hope this question doesn't leave non-British Columbian listeners too much in the dark, but basically, can you give me an example, maybe one or two quick examples of what would constitute extending in your math world?
That's such a good question.
So, it's tough, right?
Yeah. Yes and no. So, okay. We're looking for at extending in British Columbia. We're looking for a sophisticated approach, right, or a sophisticated understanding of the material. So there are, I think, in mathematics, two ways that are most accessible for teachers to create these kinds of opportunities. And we have a rule that any assessment that we give must include opportunities for extending that the student can reach without having external tutoring or learning going on. So it has to come from extensions that a student in your class could be able to actually reach. And those two ways, therefore, would be synthesizing two topic areas together. So if a student's learned fractions and a student's learned geometry, somehow bringing a question together that requires the student to use both of those skills, or a student solving a question that is unfamiliar to them. And so if they are, and not unfamiliar as in the next grade level, but unfamiliar as in, I know I have given the student the mathematical tools to solve this problem. We haven't done one exactly like this in class. So it's not perfect. I often say to the students, here's the one that's unfamiliar. I just want to see how you approach it. You don't have to have a perfect solution to it. That seems to have been quite successful. So thanks for putting that proficiency scale up on the screen. Again, podcast listeners wouldn't be able to see it. But yes, extending, our definition here is student demonstrates that sophisticated understanding of both the concepts. So the skills and the content and the competencies relevant to the expected learning and doesn't go beyond grade level. It is something that is achievable for the students in your class.
Interesting. Okay, that was perfect. Thank you so much. And I'll be listening to that again after the broadcast. But thank you so much, Phil, for allowing me to call an audible on that one, thinking of the Super Bowl on the weekend. All right, let's keep going. Shifting gears a little bit, Phil, outside of education, what's another area of learning for you? What is it that ignites your passions outside of the classroom and brings you alive as a human being?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm right after this running off to coach my son's soccer team. Love doing that. I love soccer. I grew up playing soccer, refereeing soccer. Once I was injured as a player, I got into refereeing and I worked my way up all the way up to the Whitecaps level of refereeing. And then my knees just couldn't hack the running. Around the same time, I was now full-time teaching. And so I got into coaching, coached high school for the last 25 years, I think basically since day one, had lots of success and a lot of fun, a lot of good memories, coaching soccer over the years. And now my son is playing, I've finally been roped into helping coach his team. So I will dash out of here after this to go coach his morning game against a Richmond team. As I said, or as you said at the beginning of this, I love spending time in the outdoors. So I grew up on the North Shore and all of the BC mountains, whether that was hiking or skiing or camping or canoeing, whitewater kayaking, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, I do my Wordle and I also play around with Duolingo as well. So I'm learning. I like to listen to podcasts, and there was a podcast the other day that was talking about Esperanto. So I was learning some French. I have quite a number of students who speak Mandarin, so I decided to learn at least the numbers in Mandarin. If I am going to go holiday anywhere, it might be somewhere where I might need a little bit of Spanish. But now I'm also learning a little bit of Esperanto, which is actually a very easy language to read or to learn. So yeah, I like dabbling around in that as well.
You are definitely a lifelong learner. I appreciate that curiosity, Phil, in linguistics is really interesting. And did I understand you correctly that you were refereeing in the MLS?
Up to. So the Whitecaps at that time were not in the MLS. I'm going to date myself, but they played out of Swangard Stadium in Burnaby. Yeah. And I was on the officials list for them. So sometimes a fourth official, sometimes a linesman. And I actually gave up the year that they moved to the MLS. So watched some of my buddies referee some of their first games, which was
fun. Well, that you're cheering them on. Hey, well, I'll say for the football fans, and I do mean football in a global sense, we're cheering on our local Vancouver Whitecaps. So if you've got a favorite, that's who we're rooting for. Phil, we're about to jump in to some rapid fire questions. So whatever comes to mind here in these questions is going to be helpful for our audience. Share about one personal habit or a productivity hack that contributes to your success and keeps your fire burning. And I will say, based on when you and I chip in on the Wordle, I think we're both in the 5 a.m. club. So maybe that's one of them. But is there something else that keeps you productive?
I'm definitely a morning person, so I'll be more productive in the morning. But I don't really like things hanging over the weekend. And often a student or a teacher or a parent will email me on a weekend. And I really try to set that time aside for myself. It's very important for balance. But I also don't like that niggling in the back. And I don't want to give the impression that I'm sending their email back to them at 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning. So schedule send is my friend. And I will compose that email, shoot it off with a schedule send for 8 a.m. on Monday and not have to think about it again. And it alleviates the issue of continuing thinking about it all weekend.
Right.
And it also takes that thing off my plate. So they're not thinking that I'm on demand accessible all weekend as well.
When it comes to Education X, Phil, tell us about someone we should follow there and share why they've been inspiring you lately.
Yeah, I've just joined Kaflan. I've gone to a couple of their other events, but the Canadian Assessment for Learning Network it's a great group. And so that is definitely one that I am following more keenly now. And I know that they have a conference coming up in October next year. So we'll look forward to trying to get there for that as well. They've got lots of members only events and great group.
One of the best conferences I've ever attended. Point us to an ed tech tool that you currently love using in your classroom or professional practice.
A tool called Podsie, Podsie. It is a quiz tool online where I can make up questions. In fact, now it has an AI generating question feature to it. So I can type in, hey, AP statistics, I would like a vocabulary list for units 1 and 2, and it will suggest questions and suggest answers. And so making quizzes takes almost no time using this tool. I can then push it out to students. Students take that quiz. All of those questions then go into a review package for them, and it automatically, based on student responses, automatically spaces and mixes out their questions as they log on over the year. So it does the job of spaced mixed practice for them so that they at least remember some of the things before their, say, AP exams. It's fantastic. Great tool.
What a cool tool. Recommend one book, one that you've been reading lately, or one of your all-time faves, and tell us why you recommend it. I know you already dropped a couple of great titles in the cognitive learning areas. Have you got any others? If you want to go back to
learning
those
how
two,
to learn. Yeah. Learning How to Learn, I mean, Make It Stick is all-time favorite.
Yeah.
And Powerful Teaching is fantastic as well. And Learning How to Learn, there's a Barbara Oakley book that is great. And that's actually got versions for students and versions for parents now. So if you want to get that kind of word out to a student group or parent group, it's got some really good resources there too.
Very cool. I know you're a podcast listener, so I won't ask you that, but shout out a couple that you've got near the top of your deck.
Oh, for sure. Embrace the Messy. Also like Tom Schimmer's podcast as well. Yeah, Shannon's here. And I really enjoy a podcast called Tea for Teaching. It's a economist and graphic designer out of New York, Oswego. Maybe not New York. Anyway, Oswego University, and they have chats about what's going on in university education and pushing some of the limits there as well. So I know we're kind of K-12 on fire here, but it's interesting to hear what's going on in post-secondary as well.
And I mean, it always affects and impacts what we're doing at the high school level, right, Phil? I mean, so much of what we do is because of, you know, fill in the blank. On the subject of podcasts and as a support to my work here, who is one educator, Phil, that you would recommend I interview on the Teachers on Fire podcast?
I'd love to hear you interview Pooja Agarwal. So she's a neuroscientist and teacher out of the Berklee School of Music. I've already mentioned her book, and I was lucky to meet her as well in Boston. Fantastic person.
All right. Just for fun, Phil, what are you streaming during your own downtime right now? What's on the family Netflix or Prime these days?
we ended up actually just finishing watching My Life with the Walter Boys. And one of our family friends is one of the Walter Boys in that show. So that was kind of cool, a local BC boy in there. And then in terms of movies, we just finished Sixth Sense with my son, and then Signs as well. So we're working our way through some of these M. Night Shyamalan. I can never say this name. Shyamalan directed films, those kind of creepy horror films as well. Right. So
okay, wow. And the whole family is up for that. I can't convince my wife to watch that kind of content.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, absolutely. Right, nice. That's great.
Phil, this has been so fun, and I really appreciate you taking the time on a busy Saturday to join me and the Teachers on Fire audience. For those interested in learning about your passions, math, assessment, and cognitive science, what are the best ways for them to follow and connect with you?
Probably the easiest is Twitter X. As you joked, my handle X and then Phil and then S for Phil Stringer. Or my passion, X-Files. I loved watching that TV show, and so that's actually why I picked it. But now that Elon Musk has decided to add X to the name, it turned out even better. So yeah, through X is probably the easiest way. If people are on Facebook, I'm in the Standards-Based Grading and Learning Facebook group, contributing there. And the Beyond Report Cards group for BC educators as well on Facebook.
Thank you again, Phil, for this conversation. And thank you, Teachers on Fire, for joining us and sharing a part of your day, soaking up the content that we've shared here. I hope that in some way, what Phil shared today and what he spoke about sparked your thinking and ignited your professional practice. And we'll see you next time right here on Teachers on Fire. Take care, everyone. Have a great weekend. Still go. Even when you feel slow, you can still go. Even when there's no hope, you can still go. I never answer to no, man, I still go.